From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today on the program, a human tide flees advancing Islamist militants in Iraq.
Our determination and our will be strong, and we will throw away and kick out these criminals and those who have helped them.
We get the latest from Erbil. Also, day two of the London Conference on Gender Violence. Hillary Clinton's book soars up the bestseller charts, and London's famous taxi drivers take on Uber.
These are ordinarily some of London's busiest streets. Today, the only traffic is black cabs, and they say they will continue to bring London to a standstill.
That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Islamist insurgents in Iraq have seized the city of Tikrit, according to security officials. It's the hometown of former leader Saddam Hussein and lies just 95 miles north of the capital, Baghdad. It's the insurgents' second major gain after capturing Mosul on Tuesday, when 500,000 people were forced to flee the city. Iraqi soldiers were among those escaping as the jihadists from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria group took much of the Nineveh province. Hemen Lahoni from the media network Ruda, based in neighboring Kurdistan, says the militants now have moved into a second province.
Now they are going to Sabahattin provinces, which is a Sunni provinces too. And according to our reporters and latest news, they could control this province too. So now two big provinces in Iraq is under the militant groups.
Taxi drivers in European capitals, including Madrid, London, Milan, and Berlin, went on strike Wednesday, demonstrating against what they say is a lack of regulation of the rival mobile service, Uber. In France, trains also did not run in some areas in a strike against reforms. In Spain, taxis were asked to observe a 24-hour stoppage until Thursday morning. The mobile app Uber, which originated in the U.S., says it is complying with all regulations. However, taxi drivers insist it is the equivalent of a taxi meter, meaning anyone with a car can become a taxi and dodge the usual regulations and exams. Cab drivers in London blocked the center of the city to make their point.
They're taking away our work, they're taking away our livelihoods and our business. And as you can see, we care about our careers.
In the U.S., there's been a major upset in the Republican Party after the number two Republican in the U.S. Congress lost his seat. Following his crushing congressional defeat, Eric Cantor also announced he will resign from his post as majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives at the end of July. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
No one in American politics saw this election result coming, least of all Eric Cantor, the now outgoing majority leader for the Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was in line to become Speaker of the House. Now Republicans are asking if the win by Eric Bratt, who had significant support from the very conservative Tea Party, is a bellwether or an anomaly.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A leading pro-democracy activist in Egypt has been sentenced to 15 years in jail. A key figure in the 2011 uprising against former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Alaa Abdul Fattah was found guilty of illegal protest and attacking a police officer. Trilateral talks between Ukraine, Russia, and the EU have failed to resolve an ongoing dispute over energy supply. A deadline for Ukraine to pay up its gas debts to Russia has been postponed to next Monday, but negotiations remain tense with Moscow upholding its threat to cut off supply to Ukraine and effectively the rest of Europe. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
No deal yet after 4 hours of talks and what was a fifth meeting between the EU, Russia and Ukraine's energy ministers. Russian state-owned company Gazprom is demanding Ukraine pay its natural gas debts or the taps could be turned off, affecting supply to the rest of Europe, which gets its energy through Ukraine. The new government in Kiev, supported by the EU, wants a price cut of $100 from $485 per 1,000 cubic meters after Russia doubled its prices last year. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned Ukraine against asking for discounts. The three sides are expected to remain in touch over the phone in the coming days to try to push an agreement.
And U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has defended the Obama administration's decision to release five Guantanamo Bay prisoners in exchange for American soldier Bo Bergdahl. Appearing before the House Armed Services Committee on Wednesday, Mr. Hagel said the deal was a tough call for the president, but that he stands by him. Kate Fisher has more from Washington.
The White House has been criticized by Republicans and some Democrats over the swap late last month. They object to not being warned of the deal and say the detainees are too dangerous to be free. But Mr. Hagel said that he and the president wouldn't have gone ahead had they not had complete confidence that they were acting lawfully in the national interest and in the best traditions of the military.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. There was more terrible news for the Obama administration today from Iraq. After the country's second city, Mosul, fell yesterday to advancing Islamist militants, they took control of another city, Tikrit, today. As the militants with ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, continue to gain ground, there are growing fears about the country's survival as a unitary state. Fears the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki addressed during a press conference today in Baghdad.
Today we are dealing with the situation. We are not going to allow this to carry on irrespective of the price. We are getting ready. We are getting prepared. We are going to reorganize the armed forces. Our determination and our will be strong, and we will throw away and kick out these criminals and those who have helped them.
But despite that rhetoric, it is the Prime Minister's inability to find common ground with opposition politicians in Baghdad that has created the opening for the country's Sunni jihadists to grab territory. And now a massive humanitarian crisis looms, with more than 500,000 people on the move, trying to stay one step ahead of the Islamists. FSN's Kate Fisher spoke to Hemin Leoni from the Kurdistan-based media network Rudor, and she started by asking him about the latest militant moves on the ground.
Now they're going to Saladin province, which is a Sunni province, and according to the latest news, they could control this province too. So now two big provinces in Iraq are under militant groups.
And what about what you know of what's happening in Mosul at the moment? What stories have you heard? What have you spoken to anyone that has fled from there? What sense do you get of the situation?
According to the government, about 350,000 people fled to Kurdistan region and 500,000 fled from Mosul. And the situation is that people stay at home. No one wants to go to the office or to work. And those who fled, they're all anxious about their relatives, their neighbours who stayed in the province. They've come to Kurdistan now. There are refugee camps. When you go to the checkpoints, you see thousands of people, thousands of cars around the checkpoints, many people without water, without food.
What about casualties? Have you seen many injured people, many people who've lost loved ones?
Of course, this was a very bloody war. They killed people, they tortured them, and they killed some on the spot. This was according to the people who fled from Mosul. And in some places near Kirkuk, our reporting says they found some bodies who were beheaded by the militants.
Is this escalation of violence in Mosul, this militant takeover, is that a surprise to you?
It is surprising. We didn't imagine that the Iraqi army was weak like this. We knew this was a weak army, but we didn't expect that the militants could control one of the largest cities in Iraq overnight.
What do you think will happen? How do you see it playing out?
I think this is the first step in the partition of the country, Sunni and Shia and the Kurdish state. And Kurdish people, most of them are expecting this. We see this as an opportunity to declare our independence and to get rid of the rest of Iraq. We can now say that a united Iraq was just an illusion, not a real thing.
Hemin Leoni of the Kurdistan-based media network Rudor on the line today from Erbil. The This is FSN Reports. Now, they are as British as Buckingham Palace, the BBC and fish and chips, with pickled onions on the side, naturally. But hell hath no fury like a London taxi driver scorned. Today, the men and women who drive London's famous black cabs brought the centre of the British capital to a standstill in a protest against the American company Uber. FSN's London correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
At the centre of the row is the London cabbie's claim that the Uber app has a GPS tracking system which calculates the passenger's fare based on the time and distance of the journey, and that this is, for all intents and purposes, a taxi meter, which only black cabs are regulated to use in London. Steve McNamara from the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association says London authorities and Mayor Boris Johnson aren't doing their job.
Transport for London are letting London down. They are totally failing London. As a regulator, they're about as good as a chocolate teapot. Boris Johnson has took a very clear decision here. He wants to back an American multi-billion pound company.
But with cabbies expressing fears for their livelihoods, Boris Johnson insists the American firm Uber is not a threat to their existence.
A black cab is the only form of vehicle that can be hailed in the street. They know all the shortcuts. They know how London really works. They'll get you there quicker. I think it's very, very early to say that the black cab's days are being kind of threatened by Uber.
Uber now serves more than 100 cities in 37 countries and has 3,000 registered drivers here in London. Its supporters say it's an example of a positive, disruptive technology. The Institute of Directors has compared this protest to machine breakers who tried to stop the spread of the power loom in the 19th century. Steve Garalick is president of the GMB Union's professional drivers branch. He says it's more than that, and that cabbies are operating now in an unfair environment.
A great deal of training to get where they're going, and they pay a great deal of insurance, and they have to protect their families. There's this common misconception that both private hire and taxi are overpriced, but when the average person actually looks at the fuel cost, the expenses that drivers go through, the issues that drivers have on an everyday from a safety perspective, frankly, people get actually very good value for money.
These are ordinarily some of London's busiest streets. They're never particularly fast moving when it comes to traffic, but today the only traffic is black cabs and people on mopeds who are driving around London's streets training to become black cabbies. They say the industry is becoming tipped unfairly against them, and they say they will continue to bring London to a standstill at future dates unless authorities step in to help them.
Ollie Barrett in Trafalgar Square. You can see pictures of that protest on our Twitter feed. You can find us there at Feature Story. And we stay in London now for news of the second day of an international conference on gender violence during times of war. The four-day gathering aims to galvanise action on the issue, and it's launched an international protocol, essentially a checklist of what governments need to do in order to overcome the problem. The summit is being co-chaired by UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie and the British Foreign Secretary William Hague. Officials from a number of African countries, including Sierra Leone, Ghana and the Democratic Republic of Congo are attending the conference. Britain's Minister for Africa, Mark Simmons, will be meeting with them, and he's been talking to FSN's London correspondent Dan Whitehead, who started by asking why this conference and why now?
The Foreign Secretary has had a real personal focus on preventing sexual violence in conflict. And at the last year's UN General Assembly, we launched a political declaration to end impunity of sexual violence, which has now been signed up to by almost 150 countries around the world. This summit that we're holding in London this week is the culmination of 2 years' work to bring together both the countries that have signed up to the political declaration, but also all those who have a particular interest in ending sexual violence in conflict, to translate and transform that political declaration into specific outcomes.
What are those specific outcomes which you hope to achieve?
Well, those specific outcomes fall into several categories. The first is ending the atmosphere of impunity, which for too long has been allowed to prevail in sexual violence in conflict areas. The second is to encourage countries to put in place legislation to enable prosecutions and to end sexual violence. The third is to encourage countries to withdraw from conflict and to hold peace negotiations and implement cessation of ceasefires, and also to provide protection for women and girls in very practical ways. So, for example, when women from displaced people's camps go out to protect, collect firewood, they should be protected to ensure that they're not raped.
There's obviously hundreds of people here, charities, aid groups and so forth. What makes this summit different to previous discussions and political discussions and campaigns to try and end this crime?
Well, there's a real energy about this summit, a real determination, not just from the United Kingdom government, but from across the international community to make sure that we can do everything possible to implement the political declaration that has been signed up to by nearly 150 countries into practical, pragmatic action to make sure that we end sexual violence in conflict for good. So ending the impunity that has been for too long prevalent, encouraging countries to sign up to implementing legislation in their countries, as well as encouraging ceasefires and the end of conflicts which often drive sexual violence.
Now, on Thursday is what's being known as the Ministerial Day. You have representatives coming from more than 100 countries, I believe, many of those in Africa, many of those in countries which are in conflict. The allegations of people who are subjected to sexual violence say that it's the prison guards, it's the police, it's the government who are carrying out these atrocious attacks. How on earth can you possibly expect to negotiate and get results with governments which allegedly carry out such attacks?
Well, the first thing to say is whilst there clearly are problems in some parts of Africa, this is not just specifically an African issue. Sexual violence occurs in all parts of the world, whether it be Central or South America, Middle East, Asia, Africa, or indeed, as we've heard just now at a fringe meeting, in Europe not that long ago in Bosnia. So this is a global problem that requires a global solution. And what I think is very pleasing about those countries that have signed up to this political declaration is that some of those in Africa that still need help, so for example, the Democratic Republic of Congo and Somalia, are signed up to the Ending Sexual Violence political declaration. They're here this week discussing how they can implement the protocols that will be set out this week and how the international community can assist, particularly those countries that have already made significant progress.
I've been speaking to people who are victims here today who've had horrific stories, as I'm sure you have as well. One of the problems they say, actually, there's a slight hypocrisy here in that when they arrive, the Home Office is disbelieving them, locking them up in detention. Those are just two of the quotes I've heard from today, and actually that the problem needs to be addressed on the UK shores as well as abroad.
Well, I think that that is unfair. I've heard some very moving and very powerful testimonies to those who've been involved in sexual violence. And obviously they're here because they have been successfully rehabilitated and they're coming back into the community. But of course there's far more that needs to be done. But in terms of the asylum point that you make, we have a very generous record in the United Kingdom. And we look at each case on its merits. We have very sophisticated and well-trained people who look at each individual case. And that's what we'll continue to do.
FSN's Dan Whitehead talking there to Britain's Minister for Africa, Mark Simmons, on day two of the Gender Violence Conference in London. Here in the United States, it's day two of Hillary Clinton's book tour. Her new memoir, Hard Choices, went on sale in the US on Tuesday. FSN's Nick Harper watched Mrs. Clinton signing copies of the book at one Manhattan bookstore yesterday.
The first person in the line reportedly started queuing at 2 p.m. on Monday, 21 hours before the book signing was due to begin. Hundreds of people came down, many of them strong Hillary Clinton supporters, all wanting to meet the person who may, in a few years' time, be residing in the White House.
As of this morning, the book was ranked number 2 on Amazon.com. So what else might it do for Hillary Clinton beyond propelling her to the bestseller lists? Christina Bellantoni is the editor-in-chief of Roll Call, Capitol Hill's newspaper. And we asked her whether she agrees with the conventional wisdom that the book is a clear signal that Mrs. Clinton will soon be running for the White House.
The book definitely reads like an I'm getting ready book. This is someone who is very politically expedient, who understands what it means to do a smart rollout, both with the press and with American voters. So they have spent a lot of time not just writing the book, and when I say they, I mean the entire Clinton family, former President Bill Clinton, her daughter Chelsea Clinton, who has been pretty important to her political career. And then obviously Hillary Clinton herself, as she left being Secretary of State, she spent a lot of time on this book to really very carefully roll out her next plan.
So how do you see the book's political purpose?
The political purpose of this book is a few different things. It's to lay out her experience working in the Obama administration. There are still a lot of frayed nerves and intense tension left over from the 2008 Democratic primary campaign. And so this is one way to say, look, we're friends, we worked together very closely. The book very much goes over and smooths some of those tensions, saying she just never worried about it. They worked really well together. So that's one part of it. It's also an attempt to really show her experience that she gained over the 4 years as Secretary of State. This is someone who served in the United States Senate. She was First Lady, but she didn't have that foreign policy experience. So now she's been all over the world, has dealt with world leaders, and has really represented America in a strong way. So that's put part of that. In addition to that, the rollout is very careful to be able to show not just that she's a strong leader, but that she's a mother, that she's a soon-to-be grandmother, that she's warm and genuine and not afraid to talk about being a woman, which is one of the mistakes that her operatives knew about in 2008, and they don't want to repeat that mistake as she attempts to run for president again.
And on Benghazi, how does she deal with it in the book? Because it's apparent that this is an issue her Republican opponents have no plans to drop.
The way that Hillary Clinton addresses Benghazi in this book is very broad and above level. Republicans would, of course, say she has not answered all of their questions, and they'd like to see her testify in this special committee that they've formed in Congress. The Obama administration is standing by her, saying she made all of the right decisions. The press is somewhere in between, criticizing some of it, but also taking a look and saying, well, she's said everything that needs to be said here.
And is this a book that helps us understand more than just Hillary Clinton's view of her own stewardship of the State Department? Or does she take on any of the big political battles that she will undoubtedly have to fight if she does indeed run for the presidency?
The book really attempts to put her in that Madeleine Albright light. This is someone who not only is one of her personal heroes, but someone who's a very close friend. She's a citizen of the world. She's out there fighting for human rights and democracy everywhere, and also talking about how technology has changed the world. And so those are things that really attempt to put her far above politics. She doesn't talk about nitty-gritty campaigns, and in fact, it's really an aside when she addresses the 2008 campaign with the president. This really attempts to paint her as someone who was out there being America's top diplomat.
That's Christina Bellantoni, the editor-in-chief of Roll Call. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight and an exploration of the moment when counterculture goes mainstream. It's an issue that's been on the mind of Peter Aspton, arts correspondent with Britain's Financial Times.
In the spring of 1977, the Sex Pistols changed record labels to sign with A&M Records in a ceremony held outside Buckingham Palace. It was not the most orthodox of business transactions. The group's previous label, EMI, had released it from its contract after a string of unsavoury episodes, not least the infamous interview, The Filth and the Fury, in which members of the band swore fruitily on primetime television. These were the days when record labels were respectable parts of the cultural establishment, carefully balancing the youthful vigour of their acts with the gentle sensibilities of their constituents. The balance was tipped when EMI's workers refused to handle the group's splenetic single Anarchy in the UK. You can't shift units if you can't shift units. The celebrations back at the offices of A&M, following the Buckingham Palace revels, were raucous. More unsavoury episodes unravelled before executives whose self-satisfaction was quickly turning to a sense of foreboding. Days later, Johnny Rotten became a little too aggressive with a friend of one of the label's directors. A few more days later, A&M too broke its contract with the band. It destroyed most of the pressed copies of the group's new single, God Save the Queen. Those that were preserved have become valuable collector's items. The Pistols, in the meantime, were named Young Businessmen of that turbulent year by Investors Review. I was reminded of those clamorous events on hearing of the forthcoming selling exhibition of works by Banksy at Sotheby's Auction House in London. Here, too, there is the flavour, much diluted by the passing of time, of culture shock. The anonymous and subversively minded urban artist cannot have imagined himself displayed in such august surroundings. Street art was not meant to take place in or around Bond Street. And yet here they are, all those images which are among the most recognisable and reproduced of our time. The kissing policeman, the ladies bowling bombs, the starving child wearing a Burger King crown. Pungent images, produced quickly and wittily, celebrations of evanescence, are now corralled into an institution that is devoted, and indeed relies upon, the enduring power and attraction of high art. The show is entirely unauthorised by the artist himself, but his early friend and dealer who has curated it, Steve Lazaridis, revels in the event's improbability. "Of course, it's a complete paradox," he tells me on an unclear phone line from the Highlands of Scotland, where he is birdwatching, miles away from any street at all. "Everyone thought it was a fad, that it would never last, and I remember the days when we couldn't sell a signed print by Banksy for love or money." Sotheby's says it expects some of the 70 works on show to sell for more than £500,000. To give the exhibition a further air of danger, the auction house has allowed Lazaridis to decorate its gallery by letting him loose with a fire extinguisher. "I just asked them and they said yes," explains the gallerist. "I felt like a fox inside a chicken coop. I really don't like white wall galleries. I did it because I could. I was trying to capture the spirit in which that art was produced." Two important points argue against the comparison of the scandals of 1977 with the show opening next week. First, Banksy is not the Sex Pistols. His tone is more acerbic than outraged. Although he has serious points to make, they are made playfully and knowingly. As Lazaridis says in his catalogue notes, "That is what Banksy is good at, seeing things in unexpected places that make people smile." Whatever reaction the Sex Pistols provoked back in the day, anything as bland as a smile was not among them. The filth and the fury felt real. Second, Sotheby's, and indeed all the auction houses and all the commercial branches of the art world, are not A&M Records. They have long realised that to be abreast of the contemporary scene, along with all its ersatz shock tactics, is simply good business. Outrage sells. There has appeared over the past couple of decades a perfect symbiosis of interests between the business of art and the daring of artists. There is no friction between them. The ability of cultural institutions to embrace any kind of statement or movement that criticises the society from which they come has been one of the dominant phenomena of 21st century culture. The positive side of this is that the artist is getting his or her message heard. Adversity is fashionable, cultural critique collectible. The negative view is that the impact of such art is reduced in direct proportion to its mass acceptance. Assimilation leads to ultimate insignificance. We should give the last word to Banksy. One of the prints on sale at Sotheby's is Morons, an illustration of an auction in which the crowd is bidding for a piece of work which simply bears the words, "I can't believe you morons actually buy this shit." The work was originally produced in response to the unexpectedly successful sale of some works by Banksy at a previous sale at Sotheby's. Disentangle that little bundle of ironies, and you get the gist of where the art world likes to graze right now. Far from the filth, far from the fury, and far from the street.
That's Peter Aspden, the arts correspondent of the Financial Times. The Banksy sale begins at Sotheby's in London tomorrow. And you can read more of Peter Aspden's arts coverage in the newspaper itself or online at ft.com. And that brings us to the end of this edition of FSN Reports. We will play ourselves out with a bit of the aforementioned Sex Pistols. Don't forget to let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. Until tomorrow, goodbye.